This morning we welcome Jill Austin as our speaker. Jill is a past chair of UUFM and current worship committee chair. Jill earned a doctorate from Mississippi State University in management, and she teaches at MTSU. Her teaching interests include business ethics, business planning and strategy, and leadership. Jill's topic today is New Year's resolutions, make 'em, break 'em, or fake 'em. Let's welcome Jill.
Thanks, Bob. Looks like we've all survived the stress of recent weeks. I realize that some of you have loved every minute of December and wished it might have even lasted longer. But others of you, just like me, probably felt the stress of too much of the seasons at the end of the year. Too many advertisements, too much shopping, too much food, too much family time, too much busyness, too much activity. This year, we also had the too much stress of continuing gun violence and too much tragedy. Now it's almost January, and now we can just stop and breathe. We can just enjoy the week and the beginning of the year. No, wait, that's not right. We have the stress of reflecting on the year 2012. We have those endless TV news videos, most of them those sad occasions that we're supposed to remember of the year that was 2012. And we have the stress of making, breaking, or faking those New Year's resolutions for 2013. Some people very happily develop a list of things to do better each year. Some people don't like the concept of resolutions at all, and so they avoid the topic altogether. Here are a couple of quotes about making resolutions, both positive and negative. We will open the book. Its pages are blank. We are going to put words on them ourselves. The book is called Opportunity, and its first chapter is New Year's Day. Edith Lovejoy Pierce. John Burroughs said, "One resolution I have made and try always to keep is this, to rise above the little things." Oprah Winfrey, cheers to a new year and another chance for us to get it right. And from the wisdom of Mark Twain, New Year's Day, now is the accepted time to make your regular annual good resolutions. Next week, you can begin paving hell with them as usual. Finally, a quote from F.M. Knowles. He who breaks a resolution is a weakling. He who makes one is a fool. These quotes illustrate both the importance of New Year's resolutions to some people and the disdain for them by others. My plan today is to tell you a little bit about this tradition of making New Year's resolutions and to offer a simple way to handle this task. Of course, you can simply ignore making New Year's resolutions altogether if you wish. According to Gary Ryan Blair, a consultant and expert on goal setting, the celebration of New Year's is one of the oldest of all holidays. It was first observed in Babylon in about 4,000 years ago. In the years around 2000 BCE, the Babylonians celebrated the beginning of the year during the month of March. The timing for New Year's celebrations makes lots of sense due to the spring, with planting and new growth that happens during that time of year. There's no astronomical or agricultural significance to January 1st being celebrated as New Year's. The date is completely arbitrary. The Romans celebrated their New Year on March 25th, but the date changed regularly due to the wishes of various emperors. In 153 BCE, the Roman Senate declared that January 1 would be the beginning of the new year, but emperors continued to change the date. According to Blair, it was not until the year 46 BCE when Julius Caesar established what we now call the Julian calendar. Caesar established January 1 as the new year, and it seemed to stick. However, in order to synchronize the calendar with the sun, Caesar had to let the previous year drag on for 445 days. Guess I just thought some years seemed long. Let's talk for just a minute about Janus. Janus was the god of new beginnings. In the mythology of early Rome, this god had two faces. Janus could look back on past events and forward to the future. Janus became the ancient symbol for resolutions, and many Romans looked for forgiveness from their enemies, and they also exchanged gifts before the beginning of each new year. According to Patty Wigington, because of this ability, his ability to see both backward and forward, Janus is associated with powers of prophecy. He's sometimes connected with the sun and the moon in his aspect as a dual-headed god. The dual face image of Janus could be found on most city gates and many Roman coins at the time. Given his role as guardian of the gates, his position as god of beginnings, and the esteem of having this month in the year named in his honor, it is apparent that Janus played a significant role in Roman myth and religion. He was invoked at the start of each day and often referred to as the porter of heaven. He particularly presided over all that is double-edged in life. This very long history of New Year's celebrations is probably the reason that so many cultures make this holiday a really big deal. Let me give you some examples of some more recent traditions, at least more recent than BCE, that are related to New Year. There's an old Sicilian tradition that says, good luck will come to people who eat lasagna on New Year's Day, but eating any other noodle will bring bad luck. In Spain, at midnight, citizens eat 12 grapes, one for every toll of the bell. Eating these grapes will bring good luck in each month of the new year. Japanese tradition says that homes should be decorated in tribute to the luck gods. Using a bamboo stalk in the decoration symbolizes prosperity. In China at the new year, front doors of homes get a new coat of red paint. This is a symbol of good luck and happiness. In addition, the knives are put away for the day to ensure the family's luck for the next year. If you cut yourself with a knife, that foretells bad luck for the year. And of course, as you know, the Chinese New Year is not celebrated on January 1st. This year, it's actually on February 10th. The tradition in the United States is a kiss shared with a loved one at the stroke of New Year. Of course, there are also New Year's Eve parties. There's the New Year's Day Rose Parade and the football game, the gathering of crowds, fireworks, maybe the list goes on. New Year's Eve celebrations have become commercialized worldwide. I'll list a few of these in the United States that seem to have interesting traditions. We all know about the Waterford Crystal ball drop that happens in Times Square in New York City. There's a peach drop in Atlanta. There's a bell drop in Pennsylvania, makes sense. This one I'm not sure about. There is a 600-pound electric moon pie drop in Mobile, Alabama. Now, for another New Year's Day celebration, food. In the South, I have always known that I should eat black-eyed peas on New Year's Day for good luck. I didn't know that this tradition dates back to the Civil War. According to Sheridan Alexander, black-eyed peas were first planted as food for livestock. Later, they became a food staple for slaves in the South. Guess what remained when the fields were decimated by all those Civil War battles? Black-eyed peas. These peas became a major food source for hungry citizens, and they helped people survive. Isn't that interesting that a food that was thought to be not worth much is now seen as a food that brings hope and prosperity? I think I'll have some black-eyed peas this January 1st, and as I eat them, I will wish prosperity and good luck on all people, especially those people who've been disadvantaged and mistreated in society. Now, if you want to step up the black-eyed pea ritual, you can add cornbread to the meal. This represents gold. Or add mustard or collard greens to the meal, and it represents paper money. Or if you want to add stewed tomatoes to the black-eyed peas, this represents health and wealth. Now, back to this question about New Year's resolutions. Do we make them, break them, or fake them? First, make them. My research shows that people who make resolutions make them about some dissatisfaction about themselves, some improvement they want to make. For example, most resolutions are about exercising more, or about losing weight, or about eating right. Here are a couple of resolutions that I expect were made by people who don't much like resolutions. I will do actual work at home on my telecommuting days. Nice resolution. Here's another one. I will enjoy the sweet side of life, M&Ms, Hershey's, and cheesecake. Or one more, I will not sit at the computer all day. I will stand for at least 30 minutes while I'm on the computer all day. More than half of us make resolutions each year. Some of us think very deliberately about our resolutions, and others are much more casual. Our resolutions are typically about our health, how we want to spend our time, the kind of person we want to be. If you want to make some resolutions, here are some suggestions. First, don't have too many resolutions. 3 or 4 is enough. Don't make the resolutions too difficult, or you set yourself up for failure before you begin. Set incremental goals. Don't be too hard on yourself if you don't follow through 100% of the time. And then consider making resolutions about satisfactions you want in your life and not just about dissatisfactions. Now, those resolutions and break them. For the most part, people break New Year's resolutions. I read that by the spring of each year, 90% of the people who made resolutions have broken them. And I don't know if this is necessarily a bad thing. I guess it's natural to not follow through all the time. We're not perfect, and we usually make resolutions that are too hard anyway. The gyms fill up in January and are mostly vacant by March. We eat our veggies, and then we see a favorite pie, and we must have a slice. You know, it actually takes 21 days to build a habit. So expect to break a resolution and then have to start over. Get through the 21 days, and the habit is much more likely to stick. Now for fake them. Sometimes we make resolutions with no intention of following through. We don't always tell ourselves the truth. Sometimes we say we want to follow through on a resolution because the resolution is something that others want for us and maybe not something that we're so much committed to ourselves. In past years, I have a tradition of making resolutions, and I've made 3 or 4 every year. My track record is pretty good, but maybe not great. My resolutions have typically been about being more healthy or doing things to be helpful to others. It occurred to me while I was working on this talk that if I can just make one resolution, and if it's a really good one, it can serve a lot of purposes and maybe be relevant for several years. And if I can just get better with this one resolution, many other resolutions I might have considered will be achieved also, and I don't really need to make more than just one. So I think I have this resolution, and maybe it'll work. You actually heard the resolution in the meditation earlier today. The meditation read, "Let us notice that what remains each year, each day, is the spirit of life and love." It's pretty simple. Here it is. Love people. Love people. Pretty simple. If I can just love people just how they are, I will find joy in life. I'll take time to have fun. I will learn some new things, and I'll want to take better care of myself. So many accomplishments with one resolution. This is just too easy. One resolution's needed, and I don't have to worry about making any others. Now, of course, this is easier said than done. Love people. I've been working on this one for a while. Some successes and some, not so much. I expect I'll always be working on this one. And I also realize that you're sitting there thinking, this isn't logical. The logic breaks down very quickly. You have probably thought of all the problems with this resolution. And I'll give you some examples to show you that maybe this makes pretty easy sense in some cases and maybe more difficult in others. First, there's that very slow driver in front of me. Love people. Okay, I can do that. Just take a deep breath. There's a person who said something unkind and untrue about a family member. Love people. Okay, I can do that after I explain the untruth. There's the person who hurt me. Love people. Okay, have to work on this one, but I think I can do it. At least I can wish them well if I can't keep them in my day-to-day life. In this case, my love people may become more that I want good things for a person. Then there's the person who did something horrible, horrific, despicable. Love people. Uh-oh. I'm not sure I can do that one. This month, we've heard about horrific gun violence. We've heard about a woman who pushed a man onto the tracks of an oncoming subway train in New York. We've heard about a sleeping homeless woman who was set on fire by a young man in California. And then there's a sad story about a turtle. There was this student named Nathan Weaver, a Clemson University student. He was working on a project to figure out how to help turtles cross the road. Evidently, the population of turtles suffers significantly every year because that trip across the road takes 8 to 10 minutes. So as part of his research, he put a realistic rubber turtle in the middle of the lane of a busy road near campus to see how drivers would react. He assumed that they would care enough to go around the turtle. He got out of the way. He watched over the next hour as 7 drivers swerved and deliberately ran over the turtle. Several more drivers tried to hit the turtle, but missed. Have we lost the capacity to care about something other than ourselves? Have we lost empathy? Back to this resolution, love people. When people do despicable things to hurt others, it's hard to love them. When people mistreat someone who is perceived as different in some way, it's hard to love them. When people are in need and others trample their rights, it's hard to love those people. When people try to break down something that's good, it's hard to love them. Clearly, the logic to love people breaks down when someone does horrific or despicable things to others. In most situations, such as examples I just mentioned, I can make the resolution work. Let's think for a minute about these people who must not be named. I'm using that phrase because I don't want to give these people a voice, these people in history that we always talk about when we think about these horrific people. You know this phrase, these people who must be named. It's a reference to Lord Voldemort from Harry Potter. According to J.K. Rowling, she described Voldemort as the most evil wizard for hundreds and hundreds of years. She established him as a ruthless and dark wizard, and no witch or wizard dares to speak his name. They refer to him as he who must not be named, or the Dark Lord. Okay, so this is a little dramatic. But we all know these Lord Voldemort types, or we read about them, that are difficult to care about and to love. Maybe some of us know several of them. These people are more likely to be people we read about in the news, but some of us may have a person like this in our lives. Am I saying that I should love people who must not be named? Well, I don't know about that. There are some despicable people who seem to have no redeeming qualities. Who are the individuals or groups of people that are your people who must not be named? Those persons it is difficult or impossible to love. There are people we may not be able to forgive for something awful that they did. We don't condone their actions. Maybe we don't even wish these people well. How I think about these Lord Voldemort sorts of people is more about what type of person that I am than it is about them. Guess what? This is the inherent worth and dignity of every person discussion now. We say that. It's one of our principles. The first principle says we affirm and promote the worth and dignity of every person. Listen to what Bill Schultz says about inherent worth and dignity. You might know Dr. Schultz. He's a UU minister. He's the past president of the UUA. He's also past executive director of Amnesty International, and he's the current leader of the UU Service Committee. Dr. Schultz wrote an article in UU World magazine in 2006. It was mostly about torture that he encountered during his time at Amnesty, but he used the death penalty to explain his beliefs about the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Here's what he said. I suspect that we as UUs base our belief in the inherent worth of human beings on some vague notion that aliveness itself is good, and that because human beings represent the pinnacle of aliveness, we inherently possess some kind of merit. Schultz says, I don't buy that anymore. He says, I have fought tirelessly against the death penalty in this country. I have visited death rows and spoken frequently to condemned prisoners. Some of them have acknowledged their crimes and altered their hearts. Others are truly innocent. Many are mentally ill. Some are vicious, dangerous killers who will kill again if given the opportunity. I oppose the death penalty, he says, not because I believe that every one of those lives carries inherent worth. In some cases, their deaths would be no loss to anyone at all. I oppose the death penalty because I can't be sure which of them falls into which category. and because the use of executions by the state diminishes my own dignity and that of every other citizen in whose name it is enforced. In other words, Schultz says, I need to assign the occupants of death row worth and dignity in order to preserve my own. I need to assign the occupants of death row worth and dignity in order to preserve my own. But he says, I find no such characteristics inherent in either them or me. Schultz asks, is the worth and dignity of every person inherent? No, inherency is a construct. It's a youthful myth, perhaps, but a myth nonetheless, that's designed to cover up the fact that we're all sinners and that we are not always certain which sins, and hence which sinners, are worse than others. Each of us has to be assigned worth. It doesn't come automatically, and we're taught to behave with dignity. So let's think about this for a minute, based on this resolution. Based on Schultz's idea, maybe I need to think about my own worth and dignity in some cases, not the other person's worth and dignity. And this resolution to love people, I can ask questions. Am I reducing my value as a person when I allow myself to be treated in negative ways? Do I discount my worth and dignity when I'm unkind to others, even when they're unkind to me first? Both seem to take a toll on my worth and dignity. When I can let go of the anger, the hurt feelings, the resentment, here is what I'm finding. When I do this, I'm less stressed. I'm happier. Other people around me are happier too. And I love people more. So let's consider what would happen if we begin every day by saying that we will just love people. If someone drives too slowly, I will think love, not impatience. If someone talks too long when I have work to do, I will think compassion. When I feel mistreated, I will think forgiveness. I think taking on this mindset every day is hard, and I will always fail at it, but I'll get better through practice. And yes, sometimes I will assign dignity to someone in order to preserve my own worth and dignity, because loving that person just can't apply. And I think this is the result. I think I become a better person, a stronger person. I think I learn not to make snap judgment about other people. I take more positive direction in my actions. I also take care of myself. I build a good habit and a way of living. Now, if we think a minute about these other six principles, justice and compassion, free and responsible search for truth and meaning, accepting others and encouraging spiritual growth, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence. If we think about each of these principles, there is an element of loving others and the concept of worth and dignity that helps us carry out these other six principles. So January is a time for us of new beginnings. We can eat our black-eyed peas. We can remember those people who were oppressed. We can wish them prosperity. We can wish prosperity for ourselves. We can make lots of resolutions. We can make none. We can make just one, to love people. This may mean that we care about the other person's happiness, we wish them well on their life's journey, or we give them grace so we can maintain our own worth and dignity. Remember also that Janus in the beginnings and transitions represented by this Roman god. It's the time of year for us to look back and to look forward. And this morning, I found just the perfect thing on Facebook. And if you like the right pages, you get really good advice. This is from Parker Palmer. He says, New Year's Eve is a curious fiction, isn't it? This planet has been wheeling through space a lot longer than 2,012 years, and the hoopla we make at midnight is just a tad over the top for one more tick of the clock. But this annual ritual allows us to imagine that maybe, just maybe, we're on the threshold of something new and better. And here's the best part. Our imaginings might come true, depending on what we do. Here's a poem by Anne Hillman that offers wise guidance for threshold crossing. As 2013 unfolds, I'll be asking myself, Parker Palmer says, a few questions that flow from the poem. What does it mean to dare to be human? What does it mean to be vulnerable to the beauty of existence? What does it mean to learn to love and never stop learning? And here's the poem. We look with uncertainty beyond the old choices for clear-cut answers to a softer, more permeable aliveness, which in every moment, at the brink of death, for something new is being born in us, if we but let it. We stand at a new doorway, awaiting that which comes, daring to be human creatures, vulnerable to the beauty of existence, learning to love. A poem by Anne Hillman. Thank you, and Happy New Year.